issues like Central America, do you know whose side we're on?
Five, four, three, two,
the Soviet-American arms race. How many missiles does an empire need to strike back? Watch the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour on public television, where complex issues get the analysis they deserve. Major funding provided by AT&T, the national corporate underwriter.
For the ABC Information Network, I'm Kate Dorden.
KFAR, best sound on radio.
Good morning, friends. Good morning and welcome to KFAR Radio's Meet a Pioneer. Today is November 9th, 1984. Each Friday morning on KFAR at 9 o'clock, we meet a pioneer. This morning's presentation is brought to you by the Two Rivers Lodge, the Riverboat Discovery, Interior Signs, Denali Chiropractic Clinic, Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop, Sophie Stations, and Larson's Fine Jewelers. In a moment, we'll spend the next hour with Mr. Everett W. Patton. But first, a little baby face to get us in the mood. Babyface, that takes us way back. It's now time to meet a pioneer. You're listening to Paul Rosenthal's Bravura Variations on Alaska's Flag Song. Good morning. In the studios with me here at KFAR Radio is Mr. Everett W. Patton. He is 76 years old. He was born on April 9th, 1908. Good morning, Everett.
Good morning, Gail.
It's so nice to have you here. It's been quite some time. I've been working on an interview with you, and I'm just pleased as punch to have you here. I would like to start off with the story of how you happened to come here. What was the circumstances?
Well, my dad was a Methodist missionary. He brought his family to Alaska from Portland, Oregon in the fall of 1913. It was quite a trip. We started out by train from Portland to go to Seattle. I had a little brother, an older brother. I was 5, he was 7 and a half. On the way up in the train, while we were always getting into mischief, and this particular time, there was a wire ran along above the windows, and Dad and Mother had been invited to go up to the dining car and have a cup of coffee. Kids couldn't drink coffee, it'd stunt their growth, so we're back there in this car by ourselves, and my brother says, "Do you know what that wire is up there?" I said, "No, bub, what is it?" He said, "That's the jumping wire." I said, "The jumping wire?" "Yeah." He said, "You stand in the back of the seat and you jump and see if you can grab it." "I bet you can't do it." And I said, "Oh, I bet I can." So I stood up in that seat and did a flying leap and grabbed the wire, and all hell broke loose. You could hear dishes crashing up in the cars. It was the emergency stop. We knew we'd done something wrong. We weren't quite sure what. And the conductors came back through the train to find out what had happened, and that's when it happened, all right. We set all records, growing halos, two little angels sitting there in the seats and didn't have any idea what had happened. About 45 years later, I was out visiting my dad just before he passed away in the hospital, and I happened to mention to my brother this incident, and Dad said, "What was that?" And I said, "Oh, the time that we jumped and grabbed the emergency wire in the train." He said, "Boy, I'm sure glad I didn't know about that," because he said, "You know, it had taken quite a few years of minister salary to pay for all those flat wheels." But we got to Seattle and got in the boat, came on up to Alaska, and got stuck in the middle of the Yukon, ran out of fresh meat. That was soon taken care of. There was a moose, young bull moose, swimming in the Yukon, and the boat pulled up alongside of him. One of the deckhands threw a lasso over his head, put the rope up and over a yardarm, and wound it around the capstan and winched the animal's head up above the deck. Another deckhand slugged the animal between the eyes when the cook came out in his big white apron with a butcher knife and disemboweled it. I had never seen an animal butchered, and so I fled to the arms of my mother, and telling her about this terrible onslaught on this poor defenseless creature, but I sure enjoyed the moose stew that night. That was real good. Then we finally got up to Fairbanks by boat and rode the little train into the depot, and all the parishioners from the church came down, and Andrew Anderson, that had the Fairbanks laundry, had the laundry wagon there and put all of our luggage and trunks and everything in the laundry wagon, and this old horse pulled it faithfully across the bridge to the Methodist Church, which was on 3rd Avenue, wedged in between the 3rd Avenue Hotel and a carpenter's shop, and then came the fire hall, because, oh, by the way, the bridge wasn't on Cushman Street at that time, it was on Turner Street. And the fire hall was right at the end of the street. Turner Street stopped at 3rd.
Is Turner Street Bridge the one they kept building over and over every year?
Yes, it was a bridge made with piling. Every year, just before the ice would go out, why, the whole town would turn out, and they'd rip up all the planks and salvage everything they could except the piling. But the as soon as the ice decided to move, why, those piling went out of there quick, because, you see, there was a slough here that ran from the Tanana River into the Chena, and that was called Pile Driver Slough. It came in from out here at the bluff, and they used to run a row of piling out into the Tanana River and put planks on or take planks off to keep the river level coming through Fairbanks high enough so that the big boats could come up. You know, when you see these pictures of all these boats parked down below the Turner Street Bridge, you wonder where all that water came from. Well, it was being diverted in here through Pile Driver Slough from the Tanana River.
Huh. I've seen all those old photographs of the just
filled with boats. Well, that's how that water got there. They had a telephone line out there, and it, because of the pile driver out there that drove the piling, and they had a man out there that either put planks on or took planks off to regulate the flow of the river.
Huh.
Just as simple as all that. But that the water doesn't come down through that slough anymore, because when they built the dike to put the highway through, why, that cut off Pile Driver Slough. Now Pile Driver Slough is just kind of a swale. It's a swamp out there.
Uh-huh.
Place where the ducks nest, and we raised a nice crop of mosquitoes there.
Huh, okay.
So that's my early history. I went to the old schoolhouse up here. We lived in the church for a very short time until we found that the view of the line was something that intrigued two little boys.
And how did two little boys happen to discover that?
Well, that night that we got into town, they had a reception for the folks, and Mother put my brother and I to bed in this apartment up in second floor back of the sanctuary, and we could hear some noise coming through a transom up there, and my brother said, what's that? And I said, well, I don't know. So we proceeded to investigate, and the next morning at breakfast, my brother said, Daddy, why are all those ladies out and back running around in bathrobes? And Dad said, what was that? And he said, those ladies out and back. Oh, he said, you can't see out and back. My brother said, oh, yes, you can, Daddy, if you push the kitchen table to the wall, put a chair on the table, and stand on the back of the chair. We were looking down on the line. That night, of course, we slept in their bedroom, and Dad and Mother stood in the chair, and within a week, why, we had a nice, cozy little home out here on about 7th Avenue and Perry Streets. And we had some delightful neighbors out there that for the next 3 years, among others, was Eva McGown. Eva, you know, was a mail order bride. She came in here to marry Mr. McGown, who was a cook, I believe, at the Arcade Cafe, I believe it was the Arcade, a chef. And they were our neighbors. She would often act as a witness at weddings. When she came into town, she came in on Fred Orr's stage, and that night, why, they came over to the parsonage and said that she'd come here to marry Mr. McGown, and would Daddy perform the marriage ceremony, which he very graciously did. And so that's one way of getting neighbors. You perform the wedding ceremonies, and then they move in around, you see.
Did you watch the wedding ceremonies?
Oh, yes. My brother and I always participated in these things. He let us throw a handful of rice on the happy couples as they would leave the premises.
Oh, my goodness. We'll be back in just a moment with Mr. Everett Patton on Meet a Pioneer.
Alaskans have always been famous for their hospitality, the same wonderful hospitality you still find at the Two Rivers Lodge, where Don and Stasha Troutman offer the best menu and interior, a comfortable, quiet atmosphere, and that famous Alaskan welcome to the people who are today's history makers. If you've been meaning to try one of the most talked about dining experiences in the Alaskan interior, don't wait any longer. Go out tonight to the Two Rivers Lodge, 16 Mile Chena Hot Springs Road.
Alaska is still a land of pioneers, like the Binkley family, who for three generations have operated riverboats in the state of Alaska.
Running the riverboat Discovery has given our family the opportunity to show so many others just a little corner of the Alaska we love. That's also one of the reasons we're proud to be a sponsor of Meet a Pioneer. This program gives us all a chance to find out more about the fascinating history of this special place we call Alaska, and we look forward to each week's program. We're looking forward to seeing you again next summer aboard the Riverboat Discovery.
A good song is hard to find. You always get the other kind. Yes, your dial is set to the greatest sound yet. 660 on your radio is KFAR in Fairbanks. Cause a good sound nowadays is hard to find.
You're listening to Meet a Pioneer. In the studio with me this morning is Mr. Everett Patton. Well, Everett, at what point you left Fairbanks a bit after that, and what happened then, and when did you come back?
Well, actually, it was because of World War I. When World War I started, the mines all started closing down around here because all the young men that worked in the mines volunteered for military service. And they said, started building the Alaska Railroad out of Seward, and the Methodist bishop asked my father to go down there and build a modern church. There was a small church there that was totally inadequate, and so we merged our congregation with the Presbyterian's church here at that time. And so there was no Methodist church here for quite a number of years.
You mean the population just kind of
died
for a while?
Yes, the town just became dormant until after the coming, pretty much until after the coming of the Alaska Railroad, and that's when the United States Smelting Company came in here and built the huge powerhouse out here and around 10 giant gold dredges, and we went on to a gold dredging economy around here. But after we went to Seward, we were there until in 1918, there had been a flood in the fall of 1917, and it was pretty much a disaster. And among other things, why Mother got terribly chilled during that flood, and her health broke down, and so Dad moved his family to the States. We arrived in Seattle the day the armistice was signed, and the town was just going wild. Well, I remained there until 1932, and I'd had to quit college because of the market crash, which caused a very severe depression, and you couldn't get a job, you couldn't find any work any place, and the last job I had out there that amounted to anything, I was a canning machine, mechanic at the Del Monte Packing Company up on 12th Street there in Salem, and I was the lead mechanic on my shift. It was a graveyard shift. I had 9 mechanics under me that watched the machines. I got 12 cents an hour, and we worked a 12-hour day, and the mechanics under me got 9 cents an hour. But you have to understand, you could buy a pound of hamburger for 10 cents also.
Oh.
And you could buy a loaf of bread for 15 cents.
Okay.
So when it was rather obvious that I wasn't going to be able to pay back the money that I had borrowed to go to college, and I was going to have to quit, and I wasn't going to be able to graduate anyway, why, I got a friend to loan me $100, and I paid off what few bills I could pay off, came up to Seattle, bought a steerage ticket, and came back to Alaska. And I rode the rods in the Alaska Railroad getting back into Fairbanks because by the time I paid for my steerage ticket and got up to Anchorage there were several college boys coming home for the same reason. Among other things in Anchorage, something quite interesting happened there. Why, I could do pretty good job of playing a harmonica in those days. I could play a chromatic harmonica. And somebody said, well, KFQD is going to have an amateur night, and if you would sign up on that, well, we might recoup some of our finances. So we went on to the amateur night program, and about four of us college kids were over there looking forward to seeing what we might win. Well, I won it all right, and the prize was a chromatic harmonica, which didn't help very much. But right after the program was over, the phone rang, and they said, is that young man who played that harmonica, is he still there? And somebody at the station said, yes, could we talk to him? And I was informed that there was a bunch of the boys from the Red Top Mine that were in town, and some of the ladies of the evening were entertaining them and wanted to know if I would come and play a few numbers for them. They would send a cab for me. Well, one of the gentlemen, the young college men, decided that he was my manager. From that time on, he'd take over. So we went to this place, which, by the way, was a bawdy house. And they wanted schottisches and polkas, which I could do a pretty good job on. Now, the beer barrel polka, particularly. And as soon as I played it once, why, the girl said, this young man can't keep playing unless you shell out. So they started pitching silver dollars, and my manager started gathering them up. So I'd play another number, and then the shower of dollars had come, and they'd all get up and dance. Pretty soon they were out of dollars, so one of the ladies of the evening suggested that they would, if we had $20 worth of them, and she'd give us a $20 bill for all those silver dollars, so then they'd pitch them all over again. Well, before the evening was out, why, I had accumulated three of these $20 bills, which enabled us to pay off our hotel bill down at the old Parsons Hotel and get out of town respectably. But we didn't. There were two of the boys that were getting off at Nenana and what's his name over here that had the Sampson Hardware. He had two Ford pickups on the train. Well, young men, that's no problem at all. A piece of wire, you can reach in and take the handle and get those open. So we threw our stuff in the back end of the pickups, and now we're sitting inside of a pickup, sitting there watching the scenery go by, riding the train. We weren't down there riding the rods anymore. We stopped at Curry that night, and just before we got there, we assumed nobody knew we were on the train. The train stopped about a block away from the station, and a man came back and tapped beside the car and said, we know you're in there, but isn't one of you that kid that played the harmonica? And somebody said, one of the other fellows said, yes. Well, he said, if you'll get off on this other side of the train, the boys up at the railroad bunkhouse would like to hear you play. So we took the hint, got off, and walked up there. Then the train pulled on up, and we had nice clean beds with sheets that night, and so I had to put on a concert for the boys at the bunkhouse. The next day, why, we rode up to Nenana, where my friends got off and bid me farewell. The train crossed the bridge. Well, they changed crews down there at Curry. And when the train crossed the bridge at Neenana, oh boy, it started to get cold. Well, here I am in Oxfords and just a light jacket on, and it didn't take very long to figure out that if I didn't do something quick, I wasn't going to be maneuvering very well by the time I got to Fairbanks. So I started over top of the train, left my things in the pickup, and when I jumped down into that coal car, and back that the engine burned coal at the time, and the fireman turned around to get a shovel full of coal, his eyes got about as big as silver dollars when he saw this kid with all the soot-stained face, because all this smoke from the chimney of the engine had been coming back on me. And he said something to the engineer, and the engineer leaned over and took a look and pointed over there to the fireman's side for me to slide in alongside the boiler and thaw out. And I was awfully glad to cooperate.
And you arrived in Fairbanks shortly after that, then?
We arrived in Fairbanks that night. They stopped the train, and the men carried my duffel bag down to the crew quarters over there about where the Newsminer building is now. They went in there and let me take a shower, get all cleaned up, and then I called Andrew Anderson, because he knew I was coming someplace, that I had arrived on the train, and he came over and got me a nice, cleaned-up, shave-polished young man.
What year was this?
In January of 1932.
We'll be back in a moment with Everett Patton on Meet a Pioneer.
Improper foundation alignment can cause serious problems with an entire structure. Problems that may disturb or even totally disrupt normal functioning of that structure. Thus, chiropractic endorses the importance of spinal integrity combined with a personal commitment to physical fitness to help each individual achieve their maximum potential for good health and proper bodily functioning. For information on how chiropractic can help you, see Dr. Carol Davis of the Denali Chiropractic Clinic, 3525 College Road, phone 479-0485.
Meet a Pioneer is sponsored in part by Interior Signs, long established as one of the interior's most professional, most dependable year-round sign makers. They're licensed, insured, and always ready to serve Fairbanks with signs of every kind. Signs for business, contracting, or creative design. So for signs that stand the test of time, call Interior Signs at 479-3859. That's 479-3859. Interior Signs at 2405 South Cushman.
Gonna take a sentimental journey. Gonna tune to 660. Never thought my heart could be so yearning. Wanna hear good radio. KFAR in Fairbanks.
Welcome back to Meet a Pioneer on KFAR Radio. We're with Everett Patton. And, well, we're up to the year 1932 now, and you've arrived back in Fairbanks, finally, in the disguise of a clean, young, well-shapen young man. What were the 30s like in Fairbanks?
Well, the first job I had in town was fixing up some automobiles. Andrew Anderson had quite a collection of old automobiles that he had acquired on bad debts and one thing and another, and there really wasn't too much wrong with any of them, but they just wouldn't run. And when I observed him sitting out there in his wood yard back of the laundry, I asked him what he was going to do with them. He said, frankly, he didn't know because Tom Gibson that had the garage, he wasn't too interested in fixing them up. And Bobby Sheldon wasn't available. I said, well, I think maybe that company that had the prime contract in the building, but the Warwick Construction Company had the contract for actually pouring the concrete that's building the actual physical building. And I went to work building the federal building, and I stayed all through that job until Warwick was ready to turn it over to the prime contractor, and we were hoisting sand to do the plaster work during the winter in the building, and I was going climbing the tower to go up and oil one of the crown shivs up there that had been used to hoist the concrete, and the ladder in the tower had deteriorated. The nails had loosened up, and I was about halfway up the tower when one of the handholds pulled off and dropped me off backwards, and I dropped about two stories and lit a straddle of a 2x12 where the platform had been when we were pouring concrete, and I hung on.
Oh.
Well, a broken artery in my thigh, and the blood followed the bone down, and I had quite a time with it. In those days, if you got hurt, why, you were... Your salary stopped. You went to the hospital, and you were fortunate to get your medical bills paid. Well, Don Adler, after I got out of the hospital, took compassion on me because when I was going to college, I'd worked in the theater, and I knew quite a bit about theater work. And Don needed somebody to kind of give him a hand there at the theater. So I fixed up a little apartment down below the stage in the theater, and I had a home there that winter. And from there on, why, I went over and helped Don, and we were running the coal bunkers. In fact, we did all the office work for the Lathrop Company over at the coal bunker office for quite a long while. And then there are a lot of other things transpired, like I worked for the FE Company, and we had a trading post out of Chattanooga for a while. Then when during the war that closed down and I went freighting. But in the meantime, they built something that had a very important role in developing Fairbanks. It was Ladd Field. The Army Air Force needed a cold weather research station to develop planes that could fly in cold weather. So they started building Ladd Field, and it was almost providential that this installation existed, because when the Japanese attacked out of Dutch Harbor, it was pursuit ships from Ladd Field that went to Anchorage because they didn't have practically any ammunition here. And they loaded up with ammunition, and they took on the attackers down there at Dutch Harbor. And that's when they first discovered that there was an airplane in the world that could fly straight up. That was a Japanese Zero fighter. It was the pilots from Ladd Field that got to see that demonstration. Well, they were outnumbered, probably 20-1, but they did a tremendous job of defending themselves. And because of their superior training as pilots, they were each of these flyers from Ladd Field were able to down quite a number of Japanese Zero fighters before that they lost their lives, and they all lost their lives down there.
What were the fellows from Wainwright flying?
They were, I think they called them Air Cobras. They had an Allison engine, water-cooled engine. They were very maneuverable, and these young pilots were very popular young men around town. In fact, like one of them was head of the Boy Scouts in town, and he was... They were very active in community affairs, and it hit the community awfully hard when these young men lost their lives, and they named a lot of streets out there, and I believe they still carry their names out here at Fort Wainwright today.
After those fellows that... And every one of them died in that attack.
Yes, they all lost their lives, as I recall. I don't believe any of them survived.
Well, that's interesting.
One of them... He was the only one left, as I recall. And when they saw the Japanese planes coming, why, he took off and went up and took them on single-handedly. And after that, there was for a while, it was only PBYs. Those are what they used to call flying coffins. They're a flying boat. It was all they had left to defend themselves with out there for a short period of time.
Well, that's interesting, then, that the reason they were out there in the first place was not for any war effort, but as a cold weather research station.
That was right.
So these boys had no idea what they were going to get into, possibly. And it was a total surprise.
They were up here to accumulate knowledge as to how military aircraft would operate in cold weather.
Oh,
that was what it was originally built for.
Okay.
Some of the more interesting things of the town, you know, we had something called the 4th Avenue Line here, and it was during the war when they decided that we always have a bunch of do-gooders around, and these do-gooders decided that they ought to close the line down with the cooperation of the military.
Now explain the 4th Avenue Line.
Well, it was on 4th Street. It was a restricted area. You see, during the gold rush days, why, Fairbanks was pretty much a town of young men without very many women. And this caused a problem. And so the line definitely served a purpose. It was, I remember Dad used to say that he considered the line a necessary evil, something to be tolerated rather than condoned, and there is a difference between tolerating and condoning something. And line was very carefully regulated and very well inspected, and we had no venereal problem here. However, they used the venereal thing as an excuse to close the line, which they eventually did close it, because the military eventually said they were going to put the town off limits to service personnel if they didn't close the line, and that was the demise of the line. But when they first tried to close it, they had a series of trials here. They tried some of the young ladies for, they accused them of operating bawdy houses for the purpose of prostitution. And the first trial, I happened to be drawn on the jury.
Now, what year was this?
Oh, boy. This had to be along about 46 or...
Okay.
546.
All right.
Well, anyway, Julian Hurley was defending the young ladies, and Harry Arend was the district attorney, and Judge Pratt was the presiding judge. And it almost turned into a circus, because you couldn't get anybody to go up there and say that they had gone and down there and spent money on the line. That would be incriminating themselves, so they didn't really have too many witnesses. And I remember this one case with Helen Baker, why, after the whole trial had been heard, and he was supposed to make his final speech to the jury. So he started in, he said, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury," and then he licked his lips, and he said, "Your Honor," he said, "could I suggest that we take a 10-minute recess before defense counsel makes his summation talk to the jury?" Pratt lowered his glasses and said, "Do you really think you needed her, Julian?" And he said, "Yes." Well, he said we'll grant a 10-minute recess. Julian rushed out in the hall, ran down the stairs, didn't even bother to take the elevator, ran across the street to the California Saloon, bought himself a double shot, then rushed over to Lavery's store, bought a great big yellow dry onion, which he took out his pocket knife, sliced it in half, put half of it in each of his side coat pockets, then came back up and told the judge he was ready for his summation speech. He started out by saying that this is a terrible thing that is being promulgated in our little community. Here we have all of these officers and soldiers that have proven to be peeping toms, running around peeping in ladies' windows to try to gain evidence on them to besmirch their character. And this is their homes. And this isn't the first time things like this happened. He said people being unjustly accused. Why, he said way back in biblical times, he said in the good book, it tells about something like this, that they dragged this lady out to the Pharisees, brought her in and slung her at the feet of Christ, and he said, this woman has been caught in sin, and what say you we do? And he said, you know, he said the Savior started writing in the sand, and he said, whichever one of you is without this sin, throw the first rock. And then he started writing in the sand again. He said, pretty soon he looked up and he said, lady, where are thine accusers? And said, well, they all left. Well, he said, I don't blame you either. Go on home. And Harry Aaron jumped up and screamed. He said, oh, he said, you can't do this. He said, counsel for the defense is intimating that the Savior condoned prostitution. Well, all the time he's telling this story, he's putting his hands down in his coat pockets, getting onion juice on him and rubbing his eyes, and the tears are streaming down his face. It was a pretty effective presentation. Well, when they finally had the jury go into the jury room and we sent for a transcript of all the admissible evidence, we found that Pratt had stricken all of the evidence that Aaron had presented. We had nothing left to convict this woman on.
Oh, my word. We'll be back in just a moment with Everett Patton on Meet a Pioneer. When Roy Larson started Larson's Jewelers on that day back in 1946, he had big dreams of what he'd like his business to become. Over the years, some of those dreams changed and others came true. Today, Larson's is still a family-owned business and one of the finest and most complete jewelry stores in the interior. Almost 40 years of skill and experience go into everything they do. Like Fairbanks, they've grown, but they're still your friend and neighbor. Larson's, fine jeweler since 1946 at 405 Noble.
He is waiting for you.
Today's Alaskans are demanding more. More style, more options, more flexibility, and more for their money. And they're finally getting it from Sophie's Station, Fairbanks' newest, most attractive contemporary living complex. Sophie's Station is a prestigious addition to our community, designed for optimum quality, comfort, and convenience. For adult living at its best, see the new one- and two-bedroom units, now available at Sophie's Station.
Meet a Pioneer is sponsored in part by the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop. Sam and Jane McConkie believe beautiful things are timeless, and everything you find at the Forget-Me-Not shop is beautiful. Fine linens, silver, crystal, decorator items for your home or office, and that little something for special friends. Forget-Me-Not adds a feeling of luxury to even the most practical items. So, for beautiful things for years to come, for your friends, your home, or for yourself, remember the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop, open 10 to 6, 6 days a week in Northgate Square. we have 10 minutes left with our guest, Mr. Everett Patton, on KFAR's Meet a Pioneer. Well, we're back, and there's some more stories. Everett, I'd like you to tell. Tell us about the tent city. Shall we start there?
Tent city out there where the Fairbanks Inn is, yes.
Now, that is a crazy story. There was really a hotel of tents that tourists stayed
in? That's right. Well, Chuck West, and it was a partnership deal. There was Chuck West and Mary Ann Frisky and Phil Johnson, the banker, that pooled their funds because they were going to build a tent city out there so we'd have more hotel rooms for the tourists, and they were going to show people that we didn't need all those overpriced hotel rooms downtown. They could provide their own. Well, at that time, we had tours coming in from over the Alaska Highway, and by the way, at that time, there wasn't any paving in outer Fairbanks. The first street in Fairbanks to be paved was Second Avenue, but the rest of the streets weren't paved, and I was bringing in they built these tent frames out there and covered them with surplus army tents, and they were equipped with very comfortable beds, and the rest of the furnishings, there was a washstand with a great big ceramic pitcher of water, and there was also a chamber pot, and they were going to use these for tourist accommodations. Well, on this particular occasion, I brought in a busload of tourists I'd picked up at Beaver Creek. The White Pass and Yukon buses brought them up as far as Beaver Creek, and then I drove them in from Beaver Creek, and as they came down South Cushman Street, the dust was just boiling, and I pulled up to the loading zone out there, and most of the visitors got off the bus, and they were signing in, but there was a very sedate old couple that were skeptically watching this thing from the bus, and finally the elderly lady said, "Well, Daddy, why don't you take a look?" So he very gingerly gets out, walks up to one of the tent frames, and opens the door, which shook the thing a little, and an avalanche of accumulated dust came pouring down off of the roof, hitting him in the face, and he wiped all the dust out of his eyes, got back on the bus, pulled off out his hotel coupons, and said, "Give these to that lady." So I got out and gave them to Mary Ann Frisky, and he had said, "Give these to that lady, then come back here and take us to a hotel." So I gave Mary Ann Frisky the tickets, got back on the bus, started up the engine, and she's standing there with the tickets in her hand, yelling, "Hey, you bring them back here." I drove down to the Nordale Hotel. This man gave me a $20 tip, and when he signed in, he also gave me his card, which read, "Chairman of the Board, Chase National Bank, New York City, retired."
Oh, my word.
Another thing that happened that I always remember was, I think it was in about 1952. We had an awfully dry season here, and the fires jumped the highways. Down here on the Richardson Highway, they jumped the highway down about Black Rapids, which closed the highway. It was, for quite a few days, nothing got through. And we had these fires, by the way, were started by lightning, not started by careless campers. And there was another fire on this side of White Horse. It was between a White Horse and where Haines Junction now is, and that closed the Alcan Highway also. Well, the railroad kept bringing tourists to Fairbanks, so nobody was checking out, so the hotels were overloaded. There weren't any hotel rooms on this particular day. Well, I had 50 people coming in on the train and no place to put them. Well, I appealed to the Chamber of Commerce, and with Eva McGowan's help and the Chamber, why they got accommodations for them in private homes. But in looking over the manifest, I noticed that there were two Catholic priests on there, but they were of different orders, and they had bought the most expensive tour that Arctic Alaska Travel Service produced, and it called for private rooms with bath. For each priest was supposed to have a private room. Well, I didn't have any hotel rooms to put them in, but the thought occurred to me about something. A miner by the name of Manny Olson had a deluxe suite in the Nordia Hotel, and Manny was out in Seattle, and Manny was a Catholic. So I got a hold of Arnie Lee, the manager, and pointed this out. I said, "Now, Manny's outside, and I have these two priests, and I'm sure that Manny would want them to use his rooms." And he said, "You're right." So I sent a private limousine over and picked them up off of the train and brought them to the hotel. The driver brought them to the hotel, and they checked in. And I had a little office in the corner of the hotel lobby, and where the drivers always came and turned in their tickets. And the drivers had taken everybody else to private homes. Well, I'm counting up these tickets when these two little priests came down, the fat one and the skinny one, and they're giving Jim Hood, the desk clerk, real cane over there and shaking their finger in his face, and Hood had enough of it, so he said, "Talk to Patton. He's the one that runs these tours." So the little fat priest, he started in on me. He said, "We bought this tour over a year ago, and it called for private rooms with bath, and you fellas just aren't living up to your agreement. Now, I can see we're going to have to cancel this tour. It's perfectly obvious. There's nothing left for us to do." So I didn't dare lose that argument. Here I've got a whole lobby full of people that have been stranded here for a week, and I'll have a riot in my hands if I lose this argument. The light went on, and I said, "Father, it occurs to me that this isn't the first time this has ever happened." I explained that the business about the fires having jumped the road, and I said, "Father, all the other people that came in on that train are putting up with private homes." He said, "That doesn't make any difference, absolutely no difference." Well, I said, "Father, this isn't the first time this happened. The first time I can recall it ever happening is about 2,000 years ago. There was this young married couple called Joe and Mary, and I said they ran into a similar condition to this in a little town called Bethlehem of Judea, and they shared their hotel accommodations with some barnyard animals, and that night the blessed Savior was born." Well, the little fat priest started to shake, and the tears ran down his face, and the skinny priest started supporting him and turned to me and he said, "Son, we'll never complain again." And he slowly led him up the stairs. You could have heard a pin drop in that lobby.
Oh, I love that story. You made a career out of in the tourism industry and travel. And you know what? We ran out of time without even getting to that part of your story. Really briefly, I would like to give you just a moment, though, to kind of summarize what that was, and maybe, in fact, Everett, you have an invitation to come back on Meet a Pioneer when you come back into town, but summarize quickly your career in that.
Well, I have some severe lung disease, and I can't stay here in the winter anymore because I just don't get enough air. Uh-huh. But I'll be back, Gail, on the 1st of April, and I'll be glad to appear in your program again.
Oh, thank you. This has been marvelous. I'm going to give you the opportunity to tell our listeners one final story about Fred Waring and the Pennsylvanians and his association with KFAR.
Well, when Cap Lathrop built KFAR, he had a very close friendship with a man by the name of Fred Waring who had the famous Pennsylvanians. Fred Waring made a recording of the Alaska Flag Song, which I have never heard duplicated or equaled. It's the finest that I've ever heard of, but Fred Waring did not think it was a perfect recording, so he would not allow that record to be used commercially. But he gave it to Cap, the master print, and they used it to sign on and sign off with. I don't know of a copy of that print being in existence today, but undoubtedly someone has a copy of that recording, and I'd give almost anything to have a copy of it, because, as I say, I've heard people imitate it, but nobody has ever done it like Fred Waring did it.
Well, maybe we can find that one of these days.
I hope you can, Gail.
Thank you very much, Everett Patton, for being our guest on Meet a Pioneer. By the way, friends, Everett is staying at the Fairbanks Inn. If any of you wanted to call him while he's here to thank him and to...
Well, I'm going to have to check out because the beds are so comfortable up there that I just can't get anything done. All I want to do is lay around in those comfortable beds.
Well, your granddaughter's getting married Saturday.
You bet.
That's why you came back.
Les is marrying a mighty fine young man, and I very much approve of it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for making the time to be on Meet a Pioneer, Mr. E.W. Patton, Everett Patton. And he will be back in April. Meet a Pioneer was sponsored by the Riverboat Discovery, the Two Rivers Lodge, Interior Signs, the Denali Chiropractic Clinic, the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop, Sophie Station, and Larson's Jewelers.
Listening to Meet a Pioneer. A taped version of this interview will become a part of the permanent oral history collection of the Alaska and Polar Regions Department at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. This program was produced by Gail Malloy.
In Boston, a verdict in the Vanessa Redgrave case against the Boston Symphony, ABC's Pat Romano reports.
Actress Vanessa Redgrave has won her breach of contract lawsuit here in U.S. District Court in Boston against the Boston Symphony Orchestra. The jury delivered its decision on the second day of deliberations, making its award of $100,000, plus her contract fee for canceled performances amounting to $27,500. During the 16-day trial, Redgrave's attorneys argued the Boston Symphony canceled her performances in 1982 as narrator for Oedipus Rex because of her controversial political views, and her career was financially damaged. The Boston Symphony argued it was concerned with threats of possible violence and bloodshed and acted in the public interest. Pat Romano, ABC News, Boston.
Ms. Redgrave had asked for $1 million in damage. It is still up to a judge whether the jury's $100,000 award stands.